It's one of the classic dance sequences in film history. Fred Astaire dancing on the ceiling in Royal Wedding. It's as if he falls into a reverie while contemplating an image of his loved one. And sure enough, he winds up on cloud nine, striding away. The story goes that the idea for such a dance number came to Fred Astaire while he was lying in bed at 4 a.m. one night. And unbelievably at the same time, lyricist Alan J. Lerner claims he had a dream that Fred Astaire was dancing up the wall, all across the ceiling, and down the other. That we learn in Café Songbook. Well, young Paul was on cloud nine when he first experienced the world of dance as personified by the likes of Fred Astaire, and he's about to tell us a story of dance and dreams and visual fanciful delights. Themes all sounded in this opening scene with Fred Astaire upside down and dancing and defying gravity. We're certainly tempted to ask, when we see this film for the first time, how does Fred Astaire do it? How does he dance on the ceiling like that? It's so seamless. If we go online, there are even some film buffs who actually take us through the stages of the scene. And Galen Fott, for example, tells us the scene was shot in a rotating cage and that 2 minutes and 17 seconds in, there's a cut to a closer shot, and that though the number feels like one continuous take, in reality, the dance section is pieced together from three different shots. When we see the collages that Paul Plumidor creates, we'll find ourselves asking just that question. How does he do it? How does it all appear so seamless? Paul Plumidor began as a dancer. He became an illustrator. He even made films. And he is now an award-winning creator of paper montage art and the author and illustrator of the book Brainchild, telling a surreal fairy tale, and of a memoir titled Archive 1957 through 1974. Paul Plumidor, who lives and gardens along the Delaware River in our area, was winner of a solo show at the AFA Gallery as part of the 2015 Northeastern Biennial, and he will be featured as the artist there at the 29th Annual Holiday Gala and Auction at the Artist for Art Gallery tomorrow evening with a piece titled Flower Child No. 8. Paul Plumidor paid a visit to the WVIA studios to take us on a journey from dancing, tap to Paul Taylor, on to dreaming and delighting in the sound of words, and to hoping to open our minds to much broader views through his compelling portraits and much more. Dancing comes first.
I was a very hyperactive little kid, but I was also kind of withdrawn. My mom went to some church meeting where they said, oh, dance is really good for kids. It brings them out of themselves. And so she said, you want to take a dance lesson? I went, I don't care, which is the way I was. And I went for the first one, tap dancing. And at the end of the session, the teacher pulled me aside and she said, you know, you're really good. And I was like, I am? No one had ever said I was good at anything. And so I got in the car and I turned to my mom and said, I'm going to be a dancer. And she went, yeah, sure. And it never changed. And then as soon as I saw New York City, I went to a dance convention there when I was maybe 12. And as soon as I saw the city, because it was held at the Waldorf Astoria, what did I know? I thought that was the whole of New York. I saw that. So then I got on the train going back and said, Mom, I'm going to move to New York and I'm going to be a dancer. As soon as I can go, when can I leave? So when it came time to go to college, my folks said, you've got to go to college. I said, two conditions. I got to dance and it's got to be in New York. And New York University had just opened the Tisch School of the Arts. It was only its second year when I auditioned. And I got in. I did a little tap dance for them. I saw my file at one point and they wrote down Take a Chance because they were doing serious modern dance. So I got in. It was a whole new world. And I just sort of threw aside my sequins and started over and trained myself to be a modern dancer.
Who were the influences in terms of being drawn to a style of dance or a dancer or a dance company?
There was Fred Astaire, there was Gene Kelly, you know, these were my heroes. And I got to the modern dance, of course, there was Martha Graham, everyone knows that name. There was Merce Cunningham, there was Eric Hawkins. And then the teachers at the school were not that well known, but were very incredible in their own right. There was Gene Erdman, who headed the school, Gladys Balin. And they brought in a lot of guests. A lot of them were doing very avant-garde things that were completely unique to me at the time. But I fell right into it. I just loved it. It just was like eye-opening. I started doing choreography immediately. And before my second year was up, I was presenting concerts at a small theater as part of the National Shakespeare Company. And I started presenting concerts there under the aegis of Paul Plumidor and Company. They were small, you know, it only sat like 50 people, but I was just in heaven. And oddly enough, I don't know why, but I started being reviewed by the New York Times, Dance Magazine. It seemed inappropriate. I wasn't really that well known, but it was just sort of one of those, like, fate wanted me to do this, so things happened. And after I graduated from NYU, they actually hired me to be on the faculty. And so I didn't do that for very long because Paul Taylor called the school one day and said, we need a male real quick. I'm heading for Europe and I'm short a male. So that afternoon I went over and rehearsed with him. And he said, yo, you want to join us? And I went, okay. It all happened very casually like that. And so we rehearsed for a few weeks and we headed for Europe. And I stayed with him about a year. And then that's when I just said, you know, I've done everything I wanted to do with this. I think it's time to move on. I also had a pretty bad back accident with him. His work is incredibly strenuous. As you see, I'm a small guy. And so it was pretty hard on me. So that was part of it too. I felt like because I had started so young and I had devoted myself 100% to it for so many years, that even though I was young, I felt like I didn't have a clue what was going on in the rest of the world. I just was in this insular bubble. So it just seemed like time to break out of the bubble and see what else was out there. I didn't realize how hard it was going to be because dance had come so easy for me.
And we have before us a book titled Archive, which is really a visual record of your dance career in images that are from the sequins,
yes,
right through the poetic images of the height of your career.
Well, at one point a friend said, I'd really like to know a little more about your past, so can you show me some photos? So I started digging up all these old images. And as I was going through them, I had to first try to sort of organize them into years and make sense of it. And as I was doing that, I realized, gee, it tells a story. And so I put just a few words with it. And actually, the book's on Amazon. And so I just did it for a friend, actually. But then it was an eye-opener for me to discover that there was a timeline and a sort of story and a beginning, middle, and an end to it.
And what about storytelling in your life? Because we'll find that you are a storyteller, not just in images, but in word as well. Was the dance and the vocabulary and the language of dance part of a storytelling sensibility?
I would have to say yes. I mean, I don't think you can do anything performance-wise that doesn't tell a story. Even the most abstract dances. You know, it's something about the human mind. We want things to make sense. And so nobody can just take things without making your mind makes something come out of it, which is a lot of how I approach the work I do now, even though there's a story built into them. A lot of the stuff I do is like personalities. I do a lot of portraitures, and a lot of times the images are revealing some inner story of the character. A lot of times I like to combine two people and to create one person. Quite often it's a man and a woman. I do a series called 50-50, and it'll be half man, half woman. But I try to combine them in a way where you can't quite tell, or it's disturbing to the mind. I really like to mess with people's minds.
Well, there you are in New York, and you've come back, and you've worked with Paul Taylor and an incredible host of others and done your own work. And you say, okay, I think I've explored this realm. It's time to see what else is out there. Where does the visual aspect come in then?
Kind of an accident. I went home. My parents told me that they were going to throw out a lot of things from my room. So I went home and said, well, I'm going to take these books. They were like, you know, picture books from my childhood. And I brought them back to New York, and I was sitting there, and there was an X-Acto knife on the desk, and I don't have any idea why, but I just took the knife and I just started cutting the books up. And at that time, I didn't know much, so I just grabbed some rubber cement and I started reassembling them. And I just did that for fun. And at one point, I'd done quite a few of them, and I had them spread around my apartment. And a friend came in, said, "These are kind of interesting. I bet you could be an illustrator." So we printed up some postcards, and I mailed them out to some art directors. And the phone started ringing, and I worked as an illustrator for several years. I got a lot of work. I worked for the New York Times, for RCA Records. I did a lot of paperback book covers, magazine stories. But what happened there, Erica, was one day I looked down and I had like a rush job and I was just grinding out some image. And I said, "You know, this is expletive." And I said, "I'm not going to do expletive. I'd rather be a waiter or whatever." And so I just stopped. And then didn't do it for a while. Then a kind of tragic incident happened with a loved one who died. And I sort of took a sabbatical. And I took like 6 months from the world and just sort of hid out in Milanville, where I now live, and just said, "What am I going to do?" And so this was actually after I had done my little stint for filmmaking. And that I just ran out of money. I couldn't afford to make films. The films I made were not bad, but it was too expensive for me to do on my own. So I started cutting up some old books again, but I made a pact with myself that now I would only do the work I chose to do, and I didn't care if I ever sold it or it was ever published. It was for me. And so all the work I do now has grown out of that. That's when I started working on this book, Brainchild, and that evolved that way. And a lot of work I was doing, I just put in a closet. I didn't really think anybody would want to see it. And a good friend of mine who I met up here, Ellen Silberlicht, who is a potter. Well, we got to be friends at the Wayne County Arts Alliance studio tour. And I went into her studio and ended up spending the whole day there. And we just became best of friends. And one day she was at my house and I said, "Well, do you want to see what I do?" And I pulled some of these things out. This leads directly to AFA, really, because she said, "You've got to start showing this." So there was something called the Northeast Biennial, and she said, "You've got to enter some." So I entered five pieces. All five were accepted. I sold two on the opening night, and I was awarded a solo show by AFA. And that all happened, boom. And so that's how I got hooked into AFA, and they've been very kind to me, and I love them there. And so that's how it started, and now I've been showing a lot, and I keep getting it out there and showing more and more, and I'm now going to have my first show in Chelsea in the city, and that's very exciting. That opens December 5th at the Ceres Gallery on 27th Street. I'm excited about it.
Well, I would
say, I've only been showing my work now for, well, it's just about 2 years.
It seems that you have a wonderful sense of the tradition. We think about Archimboldo with the sense of the assemblage from the fruit and the veggies,
yes,
and so forth.
Making things something they're not. And yeah, and that's kind of why the way I'm working now with people, it's also I'm making a new person out of several other people. And so it plays with the mind.
Not only is Brainchild in verse, you used the word epic. We're not just talking da-da-da-da-da-da-da, are we?
Well, in some ways we are, because I love to write limericks. I love to work with words, and I like the way they sound. And it is written in that kind of verse. When I started this book, I said, "What's the most popular poem I can think of?" And it was The Night Before Christmas. So it's written in the same verse as that, same meter. And it started as about 10 images, and it was maybe 20 pages long. It's now 180-something. And has over 100 images in it, because what happens is I put it aside, I bring it back out, I read it, I make changes. I'm one of those people who, when I'm sleeping, I go into very strange states that are not really asleep or awake, and that's when I write a lot of poetry. And I have to wake up and write things down, because the next day I have no idea. So a lot of it is sort of dream state. So it started as a very simple story, and it expanded and expanded and kept unfolding.
But what about some of the fantastic images? There's a strong sense of dynamism and the tension of the opposites, and that's what makes them so alive. They almost vibrate.
Good. I hope so. Yes. Well, I would say that my dance study had the most to do with that. because it probably only makes sense to me, but when I make a collage, I feel like I'm choreographing. You know, I learned a lot about stage imagery and balance, tension. That's what theater is all about, especially dance. And so I try to do the same thing with images. Yeah, and a lot of that too is, again, because I think it plays with your sensibilities of your expectations. I go back to this all the time, but when things don't make sense, the mind creates some kind of link or story to make sense out of it. We have to find a way to make sense of things. And the mind just won't accept otherwise. My job as an artist is to provoke and to kind of throw things at you and then say, you make sense of it. I can tell you what my own story is behind the image, but that's not interesting to me. My interest is more, you tell me what you see.
At your shows, do people come up to you and say, oh, Paul, this reminds me of...
Well, what I like about when I watch people at my shows, the thing that I enjoy the most is that people tend to spend time looking at my art. I've been to a lot of openings where people, you know, yeah, and then they drink their wine. People actually go around and they stand in front of each one and they look at it and they tilt their head and they look at it. And I love that about it. A lot of times if they're looking at something that isn't framed, they'll ask me if they can touch it because it's confusing. You can't often tell. You know, a lot of collage things are ripped up and slapped together. I try to work in a surgical kind of way where I'm assembling things in a way where they meld into each other and become united. Now, my most recent work, I call cut-ups, and I'm slicing things so that you can see the cuts, but I'm still assembling them in a way where they blend. I can't get away from that. It's just what I like to do. But I now like you to see that, okay, that was cut there and that was cut there. But then how the heck did he get them together? And I don't do anything in computers. It's all paper. It's mostly from the 19th and early 20th century. So I like really old paper, especially if I can find early color imagery. I like those soft, washed out old colors a lot.
Talk to us about the image that we'll see when we attend the AFA event.
Well, that image is from a series I did a while back that I call Flower Children. And that's where I was uniting a flower with a person to create a person who is a flower or a flower that's a person. Again, it's more like the exposition of personality. So I've worked with all kinds of flowers, orchids, whatever, but this one is called Flower Child Number 8, and it's a lovely woman in profile. There's a beautiful sort of Renaissance castle in the background. It's very warm fall colors, which I think is appropriate for the time. And basically, instead of a head of beautiful hair, she has a head of beautiful geranium leaves in various colors, and it's very romantic.
It opens up to the dream, to our dream.
Oh, dreams are very much... I'm very much sort of the illustrator of dreams. Yes, I like that title. What you don't see here, and you won't see it AFA yet, but I do shadow boxes. So at one point I decided I wanted to sort of see if I could take these ideas into a third dimension. So I like to buy old 19th century shadow boxes. A lot of them are usually lined in ancient old silk, which I try to leave. And then I use paper and I layer it into various dimensions, but then I like to also add objects to that. Some favorites are eggs, keys. I like things that sort of scream of potential, like a door could be opened by a key and a bird can be born from an egg, but these are things that are not yet what they will be. And I love to burn money and put that in there. I know that's not really something you're supposed to do, but I'm a bad boy sometimes.
It's time to ask you to read something for us.
I'll go a few pages in. 10 long years slipped away in a blur of buffet. X had made it quite clear. If she wanted to stay, he'd want sausages, oysters, chocolate souffles, canapés, casseroles, and banana parfaits at the drop of a hat any time of the day with a smile on her face, or he'd send her away. So firmly established in her one-member cult, no longer a child and not quite yet an adult, she became so adept at producing results, she no longer required any books to consult. The richer the menu, the more X demanded. His appetite grew and his waistline expanded. Resigned to her duties, Louise planned campaigns of rich butter cakes, flank steaks, fondue, and champagne. To X, she was merely a kitchen appliance, churning out meals with a perfect reliance. And just to be certain, he was never disturbed. She was always prepared with the perfect dessert.
It's clear that you love the sound of words, but also we can taste those things. So your work is multisensory.
Yes, well, in the story, this is a girl who is an orphan with a mean uncle. Typical sort of 19th century setup. And she hides in an attic and discovers books and reads to the point that things start coming out of her head. Anything she thinks of, she can produce through her mind. And of course, when she tries to figure this out, she goes to her uncle, "What's wrong with me?" And he says, "Well, why don't you look at a cookbook?" And so that's, we just heard about that. Yeah, and then of course, at one point, she can only think of cabbages. And so he just sends her away and she has to go solve. And that's when her journey begins to find out what's wrong with her and how she can solve it. And she starts meeting a lot of crazy and wonderful characters. And it has a happy ending, but not the one you think.
Award-winning paper montage artist and author Paul Plumador, speaking with us and reading from his book, Brainchild, in anticipation of tomorrow evening's special event. It's the 29th Holiday Art Auction, sponsored by the Artists for Art, held at the AFA Gallery, 514 Lackawanna Avenue in Scranton. A wonderful chance to see art from the fine artists in our region. And also, you will be able to see a featured piece by Paul Plumador titled Flower Child Number 8, Paper Montage Art 8x11. And it is framed, and it will be part of the raffle there. And also, there will be music from Rich Jenkins, who is a jazz performer in the area. There'll be wonderful, tempting desserts and hors d'oeuvres. And Ken Rivenberg will be on hand. He's a first-rate auctioneer, and it is the 29th Holiday Art Auction, hosted by Artists for Art, 514 Lackawanna Avenue in Scranton, and tomorrow evening is the time. There's a preview at 6, and the activities actually get underway at 7. If you need more information on the web, artistsforart.org, artistsforart.org. The 29th Holiday Art Auction and Gala, getting underway at 6 with a preview, and the auction at 7, the AFA Gallery, 514 Lackawanna Avenue in Scranton. For more information on the web, artistsforart.org. The featured artist this year, Paul Plumador.